Welcome to Straight Talk on Health. I'm your host, Dr. Chet Zelasco. Straight Talk on Health is a joint production together with WGVU in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I examine the practical application of health information, nutrition, exercise, diet, supplements. I look at the science behind them and let you know whether it's something to consider or not. You can check out other things that I do on my website, drchet.com, and please sign up for my free emails. Now, this episode began with reading yet another article about the dangers of dietary supplements. Well, rather than review the entire article, let me just recap what I said in response to the posted article on those dangers of dietary supplements. Quote, "This article is tired and old, restating what others have said dozens of times. Most of it, a simple retread that do not ask the correct questions. While it is true that some herbals interfere with the detox system to metabolize chemotherapy drugs, has it impacted the efficacy of chemotherapy? That doesn't seem to have happened with statins, medications used to lower cholesterol. And as for the beta-carotene study, the amount of synthetic beta-carotene given to the cigarette smokers was 30 milligrams per day when the typical intake was less than 6 milligrams per day. Why would researchers select amounts 6 times the average intake in a human trial? If you're going to print something like this, which inspires quacks and people with a miracle story to respond to, at least do a better job of actually investigating the claims. Writers, do better than this." Since the American Medical Association and the Food and Drug Administration have teamed up to train doctors about how to question patients and report any adverse events as attributed to any dietary supplements they take, these types of articles have appeared over and over again from different expert sources, but they're also reposted on clickbait websites. And make no mistake about it, the Cancer Research Center is world-renowned with exceptional researchers, so I know that they can do better than spout the party line, so to speak, when writing articles to inform the public. I'll come back to this later when I talk about the CARROT study, a beta-carotene study referred to in my response. Now, when you're a researcher and scientist, you almost always have that one question when reading research. Now, I remember going on interviews for my first academic position. At one university, one of the faculty was someone I had seen for several years at sports medicine conferences. His question was the same after every presentation, and it goes something like this. "Could you please explain the difference between the internal versus external validity of the study?" Now, you'd have thought that knowing that was his question, I would have been better prepared when I presented my dissertation research to the students and the faculty during the interview process at his university. I wasn't experienced enough to anticipate that was his question. I fumbled and mumbled around and gave some sort of answer. It was pathetic. But that was then. Just so you have an idea of what that means, internal validity is to control variables so that it can remove any inherent bias. So the simplest example would be, consider the age of assessing people for sarcopenia, the loss of muscle tissue. As sarcopenia happens naturally as we age, if we did not consider age, it could bias the results. External validity is how well the results of a study applies to the population in general. This is often much more difficult. An example, as has happened for decades, is using the same criteria for diagnosing heart disease in women, the same as for men. It's taken a long time to finally get research on women, which shows that while there are similarities, there are major differences in how myocardial infarction is diagnosed in women and men. It has caused underdiagnosing myocardial infarction in women until just the last 10 to 15 years, and even today, there's still more research that's needed. My question? A lot simpler. Can the methods used in assessing variables actually provide meaningful results? It's not just whether a test or a tool can measure what it's supposed to measure. Rather, is the standard error of the measurement small enough to provide meaningful differences? That's why I've always criticized the use of food frequency questionnaires in food intake studies. It's just not precise enough to provide meaningful differences in things like the mineral intake from foods. Yet another is cholesterol levels. The standard error of the measurement is plus or minus 20 milligrams per deciliter, as best as I can find. Yet physicians prescribe medications if someone has a cholesterol of over 200, like 205. They could be as low as 185 or be as high as 225. Yet no attempt has been made to make those measurement errors tighter. That's where I begin, even if it's a methodology I'm not familiar with. If the standard error of the measurement is wide, the predictive meaning of the test results is relatively meaningless in the real world. In case you were wondering, the internal validity of my study was not strong, as I decided to control the fewest number of variables. I felt that important so that the external validity would be applicable to a majority of the obese population at that time. Back to the carrot trial. This is the most often cited study for talking about the hazards of taking dietary supplements. Now, the idea was that taking high levels of antioxidant, like beta-carotene, would reduce the cases of lung cancer in cigarette smokers. Why? Because cigarette smokers who eat a lot of vegetables have lower rates of lung cancer. But then why pick 30 milligrams in a supplement when the typical intake from food was before 4 to 5 milligrams of beta-carotene per day? It never made any sense, except that after checking the background of every researcher cited that wrote the study, none were nutritionists nor dietitians. The study was flawed from the beginning. Years later, researchers found that high amounts of beta-carotene were actually prooxidants at those levels, especially in the lungs. You can't blame the carrot study researchers for things that hadn't been done, but there was still no reason to use that high a level of beta-carotene in the study anyway. Dietary supplements can be used effectively and safely. Hand-picking case studies and flawed research papers to suggest that they all can be dangerous is just plain irresponsible. You got to ask the right questions, people. Flipping to another study on coffee that was recently published, in this case, researchers examined the relationship between coffee and tea intake with diagnoses of dementia and tests of cognition. That's the ability to learn and remember things. In this case, researchers used data collected from the health professionals' follow-up study and the nurses' health study, resulting in a total of just over 131,000 subjects that were followed for, get this, up to 43 years, depending on when they entered the study. The method used to assess coffee and tea intake were validated food frequency questionnaire, which, as you know, as I just said, is not my favorite assessment device. But in this case, because they were just looking at cups of coffee or tea per day, the method was acceptable. It would not be acceptable if they were trying to assess the phytonutrient content from the coffee or the tea, as those can vary by the type of beans or the type of leaves used. The food frequency questionnaire was completed every 2 to 4 years during the study period. Primary outcome was a diagnosis of dementia via medical or physician records. Secondary outcomes were the scores of recognized tests used to assess cognition and learning. So what did they find? Well, during the follow-up of 43 years, with an average time of just over 36 years per subject, there were just over 11,000 diagnosed cases of dementia, almost 8,000 cases, or 9.2%, in the nurses' health study, and just over 3,000 cases, or 6.2%, in the health professionals' follow-up study. While the statistical analysis was complex to account for the high number of variables, here's the bottom line. Drinking 2 to 3 cups of caffeinated coffee, or 1 to 2 cups per day of tea, or having 300 milligrams of caffeine was associated with the lowest risk of developing dementia compared with no consumption. Further, increased coffee or tea consumption was associated with higher cognition scores and lower cognitive declining scores on the various paper and pencil tests performed by the subjects. If you love your coffee or tea, all I can say is, bottoms up. That's all the time I have for this episode. If you like the podcast, please hit the share button and tell your friends and colleagues about it. Until next time, this is Dr. Chet Zelasko saying, health is a choice. Choose wisely today and every day.